Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Dammit. I'm your host, Jennifer Weigel, and joining me in studio, Paul Selig. Paul is a channeler, an author, a psychic, apparently, according to Nightline, the love psychic. How are you, Paul?
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for having some time in your day to spend with us, because last night we had an event with you at the Wilmette Theater where over 100 people were, I would say, blessed to be in your presence while messages came through you. And as those messages were coming, now we have to let our listeners know, first of all, Paul, before he became a channeler, and while he was also a channeler, keeping it on the down low, he is, and was rather, in academia. He was a professor at NYU for 25 years, got his PhD from Yale. No slouch in the education front at all.
MFA from Yale.
Thank you, MFA, even better. And as you were in academia and your gifts opened up and you knew this was happening, you kept it under wraps for a good while, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I mean, I had a professional life, and my life and my spiritual life was informing my work in the classroom, but I wasn't talking about it per se.
Yeah.
But eventually, it took over, and it's now what I do and what I'm known for.
So a year and a half out of leaving academia, right?
Fully out, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm on the board now of a college. I'm on the board of Goddard College, which
nice.
I ran a graduate program for many years. But yeah, I left teaching about a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were there ever days where you went, what did I just do?
Why did I just leave?
Yeah.
Do you mean that? Yeah, yeah. Certainly there were. But, mostly it's because I really liked my work in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed the students, and I was very good at what I did.
Right.
And I like routine, you know. I like knowing what my schedule was. And I live a very different life now, and I'm on the phone, you know, much of the day with clients or on Skype or in my office seeing people, and then I'm traveling.
Right.
So the kind of community that I had through academia, you know, and the kind of regularity, that's all been sort of blown away, but it's a very different life now, and it's an exciting life as well. It's just, I'm a creature of habit. I like the known.
Exactly. And so here you are talking about liking the known, and what your guides tell you a lot is to claim the unknown.
Yeah.
One of the messages that I sat in for, because once a week you will sit and you will give message and you, you know, broadcast these over Zoom for those who want to kind of tune in. And the one that I was listening in on was claim the unknown. And how scary that is for many people to do, but that's what's required of us now. Rather than thinking we have to have the GPS and we need to turn left and turn right, there's going to be some kind of trips along the way.
Well, I mean, you know, when you claim the known, you get what you've always had. I mean, that's really what we've been taught to do, and I think how we've been raised to live our lives is to meet a set of expectations of what it means to be a man or a woman or a worker or successful. But when you move beyond that kind of frame, there's a tremendous amount more that can be claimed.
Right.
So what I'm doing now is a big step into the unknown, but it was when it first started for me, and it started when I was in my mid-20s.
Right.
And, you know, it was a radical change when it began. It just gets bigger and bigger as it goes forward, but it also gets more normal. When you begin to work with this stuff, the idea that the world isn't what we've taught it to be and that there might be much more to it becomes evidential. You have your own experience of it, and that confirms it. And it's just then it's just the world you live in. It just doesn't live by quite the same laws you thought perhaps that it was supposed to.
Your most recent book, the newest, is The Book of Truth. And one of the major takeaways that the guides talk to you about is claiming this statement. I know who I am in truth. I know what I am in truth. I know how I serve in truth. You are now currently reading the audiobook and rereading the dictated channeled information. And you mentioned last night that that was eye-opening for you as a reminder of kind of what's not sticking in a way, because you are indeed human.
Yeah. I mean, it's a high teaching there. Now, this is the fifth book in a series.
And you're working on the sixth.
The sixth one is I haven't started the sittings yet. I mean, the books really aren't written. I sit in a chair, I close my eyes, my guides start to talk, it's recorded and then transcribed, and the unedited recordings become the book. So my process of delivering a book is one in which I am passive in some ways to the reception, and then I will read the transcript or look at the book, but it's a very different experience to sit down and read the book word for word in a recording studio that was delivered while your eyes were closed and you were just essentially repeating what you were hearing without necessarily comprehending it fully. So now I'm being asked to comprehend it. And it's a very radical teaching.
Yeah.
And the guides say, you know, in truth a lie cannot be held. And the truth of who we are is as a divine being or a true being, an eternal being. And we've over-identified through personality and inherited structure in a way that is highly limiting. And so when I hear these words, you know, my small self and my personality self still likes to go, yeah, right. You know, yeah, right. But, you know, what about this and what about that? But I can't really fault the teaching. I mean, in five books now, they've been delivering a teaching in sequence that continues to build and is coherent, and they don't contradict themselves. You know, and these are five books that weren't written and require no editing. I mean, there's no editing. There's a few words that I might have transcribed wrong in a book of, I don't know, how many thousand words make up a 350-page manuscript. So I'm in admiration of the text, but am I the best student of it? Not all the time.
Right.
You know, not. But I'm hoping to get there.
So for those who haven't seen how you work, explain what happens when you're hearing it. It's a clairaudience. You're hearing this voice, and you were told even with Book of Mastery that there were nine guides at one time. Mm-hmm. Does that change? Does the number of sources, or you just don't know? You just
I have
know
no
what you
idea.
Hear.
Yeah. I have no idea. I mean, when they said, there's a quote in the Book of Mastery, which was the last book, and they said, I mean, it was some to the effect of, you know, there's nine of us here today working with you. And they were pretty much saying, you know, sit down in the chair and trust this process because we are present for this work. And it was at a time when I was really rebelling against the teaching that was coming through. So there was a fair amount of what felt to me like exasperation with my resistance. But I do resist the teachings as they come through if I can't wrap my brain around them. And that means that because the rule with the books is that I can't, you know, I can't change anything, it means that I'll say, or the guides will say, Paul is interrupting.
Yeah.
When I have a question.
Right.
And they'll say, this is Paul's question. They'll phrase it, and then they'll choose to respond to it in the text.
Right.
Or they'll say, we'll get to this later.
Yeah.
Or we're not going to stop right now. We're trying to teach. Would you let us? And then perhaps they'll get to it when they want to.
Right.
But at that level, it's a collaboration only in that I intercede.
Right.
But how many there are, you know, that I don't know. The experience is always of a singular for me in that there is an energy that becomes present. I mean, this is what happens when I channel. I'm sitting in the chair. I do my little prayer protection that I've always worked with. And I'm usually imagining that I'm climbing into the back seat of a car and turning the steering wheel over to the guides.
Right.
And then if I'm really lucky, I'm in the back of the back seat of the car with the magazine that I'm reading and sort of not paying much attention.
Right.
And then I'll hear one phrase being repeated insistently, and then I'll finally give it voice. And so if I hear, we have to say, we have to say, we have to say, finally I'll open my mouth and say, we have to say, and then all of the rest of the language tumbles out behind it.
Right.
Nonstop until they say, stop now, please. And that can be after a 20-minute lecture or, you know, as long as an hour and a half of a sitting.
And then period, period, period.
Period, period, period. That's when you know they're done.
That's when you know they're done.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, somebody in the audience asked about guides and how she had been told that she had this certain guide. And I loved your answer because people get so caught up in the what, right? What their guide is, who it is. It's Aunt Millie. It's Grandma Josie. Whatever it is. And your answer was really, really wonderful in the sense that it was like, I don't know who it is, but we all have guides, and it might be different for everybody, but to attach it that it has to be one grandma or three angels, talk a little bit about what they tell you our guides are.
Well, they don't talk about that per se, and, you know, there are people, and that's their work, you know, to hook you up with their spirit guides, and, you know, what I get is yes, we all have them, but the interest that my guides seem to have is much more about people moving into an awareness of their own knowing, which is theirs. It's the part of them that knows. The guides say the small self thinks and the true self knows. And to move into your knowing, which is a psychic ability, actually, it's claircognizance, it's true knowing, means that you're not looking elsewhere and outside the self necessarily for information. So one of the challenges, I think, in the new agey stuff is that people get attached to you know, the great names, you know. And when I was first coming into this work in the early 90s, I guess, in New York City, and I had been opening up psychically and was doing energy work, you'd hear things like, well, there's an Archangel Michael channeling on the Upper West Side, but go to Brooklyn because Gabriel's really great. And I thought this was the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. It was like competing angels, you know?
Right.
And what people were doing was they were ascribing all this ego to a name, you know? And I kept people that come to me very frequently in my office, and they're getting messages from this one or that one, and perhaps they are. But I think that what's truly important is the quality of the information and the truth. And, you know, is this coming in love? Is this a fear-based teaching? If it's a fear-based teaching, it's a lower teaching. And this is, I think, what I said last night. You know, my grandma, you know, had a great recipe for pudding, you know, and she's on the other side. I would love to have that recipe, but I don't necessarily want relationship advice from her. She was married about 5-6 times, you know what I mean?
Right.
That's not the person I wanna hear that from.
Right.
So I work with a collective. It's a we. They say we. And I'm comfortable with that. And there are times when I'm working that I'm able to discern one guide from another. And that's primarily through fairly subtle changes in language. There's one guide that says things like, tell the young lady this. And it could be a 90-year-old woman in front of me, but tell the young lady this, tell the young man that. And he'll say dears, mm-hmm. which makes my skin crawl because that's not a word that I like to use. It's
yeah.
rather a feat, but that's the word that comes. And the primary energy that works with me has got this sort of British accent and is rather big mm-hmm. energetically and talks about sound and tone and singing and be in your song and all that. But it's all really of the same stuff. There are other psychics that have come and watched me work, and they've actually seen the different guides step forward
yes.
as I work. And I had one guy who'd never seen anything like it come to a group, and he saw two or three orbs trailing me. And then right before I was doing an exercise where the guides really sort of assume me and they really step into my body very fully, and my eyes even often change color when they do that,
yes.
he said, I saw this orb just jump right into you. And he'd never seen anything like it. And I said, well, that's fine. You know, there's lots of different ways that people see energy.
Do you feel you have to protect yourself ever, or you're not worried because they leave when they're done? They don't just hang out and rent you for too long.
Well, it's a collaboration at that level. When I first started channeling, and I was barely thinking of it as channeling, I was just hearing things that came with this very palpable energy, and I was much more interested with the energy.
Yeah.
You couldn't fake the energy. If I was sitting in a group and I would hear for 30 people, receive a hand on your forehead, and everybody felt like a hand was being pressed against their forehead, we were in a collective phenomena, and I liked that. That was exciting for me. But the language and the teachings were sort of, oh, well, there's that information that's coming as well.
Right.
But I used to do a group in Connecticut, and I was always terrified that I wouldn't be able to hear. Like, mm-hmm. all these people would show up, and nothing would happen. I was terrified. And one night, I heard before the group, can we have permission to merge? And I said, okay. And I felt this download of energy. And since then, I've never felt like I have to go anywhere
right.
to access. In the old days, I literally felt like I had a tin can up against my ear and I with a string, and I was hoping somebody else was going to grab it.
Right.
Now, in terms, and that's not the experience anymore, but when I'm reading for people, which is a different skill set, I am hearing many different people.
Right.
You know, I can be hearing, I suppose, their guides, but I'm often hearing aspects of the client or the people in their clients' lives.
The living, too.
The living.
We're not talking about the dead.
They
yeah.
call me a medium for the living, which
yes.
is I have this odd ability to step into people that are still here on this plane and sort of become them. I might start to resemble them, and I can mm-hmm. hear them, and, you know, it's a form of telepathy, I suppose. But that's a different skill set. I work with a protection when I work regardless, and it's not because I think that it's scary, you know, and there's bad stuff, but it's kind of like safe sex. I think it's smart.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea to take an umbrella out when it's raining, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are people, there's energy, I'm sure, that's available that's not necessarily working at a high level, and that's not what I want to be tuning into. It's not my work.
Do you think, do the guides talk at all about that, the darkness that can attach to us? Do you think that that could be a cause of some addictions and depression and things that are going on? I know you speak very openly that you're not a medical intuitive, mm-hmm. but sometimes you see somebody and you go, gosh, Johnny, you're just not acting like yourself.
Yeah. I do think that there are those things, and I suppose you can say that they're lower astral and they're parasitic energies, and I think that we can pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
I've had my own encounters with them, and I once in a while will be doing a workshop and somebody will step before me in the workshop and I'll tune into them and I'll hear an aspect of that person say, "You're not going to get rid of me," and I'll go, "Okay." And then the guides will usually come in, mm-hmm. and they'll say to you, "Paul, step out. We're going to handle this." And then they'll work with clearing the energy.
Mm.
And you feel it. I mean, it's a freaky energy that when it starts to move. But I do think that often addiction can be accompanied by something like this. And it's not necessarily that it's something that we pick up. I think what happens sometimes is we create our own demons. You know, we through constant fear, constant worry, these things sort of take up residence in the energy field and they get activated.
Right.
I know for myself that, you know, I can't drink, I can't do drugs, I have to watch sugar. I'm super sensitive, you mm-hmm. know, and I can get addicted to anything.
Yeah.
And I really don't want to.
Right.
So I have to be somewhat responsible at that level to my own system.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was first opening up clairvoyantly and I started seeing energy fields, I used to see people at times who were in early recovery for addiction, and they literally used to have, like, you know, this sort of smoky stuff over the crown chakra.
Sure.
You know, and like this mucousy energy, and then you'd watch them periodically over months and it would clear.
Right.
And it was the field clearing. It was quite wonderful. You know, my real abilities and the channeling that I do now and the level of clairsentience that I have, which is the ability to step into other people and feel what they're feeling or look like them, that came after I quit smoking cigarettes.
Mm.
And that was maybe 12 years ago now, and I was a 4-pack-a-day guy.
Wow.
I loved it. I smoked. I had a big cloud of smoke wherever I went, all around me to keep me safe.
There you go.
And I wanted it, and I didn't want to quit, and I did, because the guide said, "We can't continue to work with you unless you really deal with this."
Raise the bar.
And everything changed. My abilities completely, completely changed. And that's when they began delivering, you know, lectures through me. As soon as my system was clear enough, and in retrospect, my central nervous system, which I think is being utilized in this work, was always on constant overload and detox, you
right.
know. And now it's available for this in a way that it wasn't, because it couldn't be.
Do the guides tell you about past lives? You'd mentioned last night that you're not big on dwelling on past lives because here we are in this
yeah.
present. But what do they tell you about? I mean, is that happening, I guess, lives at the same time, because there is no past or present,
yeah.
but or past or future? What do they talk about with that?
Well, they haven't talked about it too much in the books. They really no. don't address it much. They do talk about our understanding of time as a construct and a collective agreement to be in time.
Right.
And that the divine self or the true self or God, if you want to use that word, is not bound by, they would say, the clock or the calendar. It exists beyond that, but it can know itself in time.
Right.
So the divine as you can know itself here. It's a Friday now. The divine is here on Friday, but the divine is always here.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, you don't need the clock or the calendar. You can move beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
So the guides actually say that, you know, and they say this to the readers in one of the books, and it's funny because people keep reporting on the phenomena, that, you know, if you're reading the book and you have a question, ask the question while you're reading the book, and the guides will actually answer it in the book.
Oh, cool.
And people said, "I asked the question, I turned the page, and there was the answer." And they said, "This is possible because we exist outside of time."
Right.
So we're with the reader as they're reading, as we're with Paul, as the dictation is happening.
Yep.
In terms of the past life stuff, you know, there's stuff that I do remember from the past, and some of it is very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend in my life who I have had recent memories that were quite nice of knowing this person in the past. And then, you know, but when I first started moving into the past life stuff, I was many years ago, probably 18 years ago or something. I was on jury duty, and I was so happy to do my civic duty and show up, and I started to have meltdowns in the court. I was a wreck. I didn't want to go. I was cold sweats, and I kept saying, I'm not on trial. What's going on here?
Wow.
And I kept hearing in meditation, in those days I was meditating regularly, and I kept hearing this name, and it was Mirandella. And I thought, what the hell is this? And I finally heard Look It Up. I thought it was an Italian restaurant, you know? Mirandella. What am I hearing? I looked up, and there was some guy named Pico della Mirandella, who was in the Renaissance, who was on trial for 7 years before the Inquisition. You know, and they said, this is the reason. This is, and I'd had a dream right around that time, which is really interesting, of some guy with a frilly collar and some monk with a big nose and a hood being carted away, you know, by guards. And it wasn't, and this was pre-internet, you know, that this stuff happened. So I said, okay, so maybe I was this Mirandella guy or this, who knows who I was. But then it occurred to me once I was on a computer and there was this thing called Wikipedia to look up this guy, this Mirandella guy, and he was a big deal. And it turns out he wrote these books on the unity of all religions, you know, back in the 1300s. And when I was on his page, there was the monk with the big nose.
Wow.
Who was burned at the stake in Florence. Hung and burned in the town square of Florence in a very famous, you know, martyrdom.
I mean,
it was a mess. Yeah. And I went, okay, so if this is who I was or I was hanging out in,
right.
No wonder I've got all this baggage.
Right. No wonder I'm flop sweating.
That's pretty much it.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's it. That's my past life story.
You know, Carolyn May shared with me a very funny story where she had a past, you know, she was like, ah, what's the point? Why am I going to do this? And she was, it was a regressionist who was working in the room. And the next thing you know, she looks to her left, you know, they do this big meditation, and she looks over, and all of a sudden, it's like, she looks down. She's this dirty man in Europe with, you know, and looks in the mirror, black teeth, you know. She's just like, ah! It's like she was suddenly transformed into France in this bed filled with fleas and bed bugs.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, it, she could see it so clearly and just couldn't wait for that meditation to be over.
Yep.
It happens.
It does happen. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm of the belief that we have enough on our plate now. And if we have stuff from the past, more than likely the opportunity is going to come up in this lifetime to deal with it.
Sure.
You know, otherwise we would all remember, you know. But I think we're all calling to us, or this is what the guides say, we're all calling to us the experiences we require to develop through.
Right.
They may not be the experience we would choose at a personality level, but they may be exactly what we need to learn through.
Right.
And if we keep looking at this as school, and that it's not about having the most, I don't know, comfortable experience possible, because, I mean, for me, comfort is a bag of Oreos and a quart of milk, and that's not what I need. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's my taking my comfort is my staying with my idea of comfortability. It's not necessarily being challenged to grow and to develop as a human being or as a spirit.
What are the guides saying that's happening right now with political climate and the need for all this disruption for our involvement?
I mean, they've been saying this since the first book in 2009, and that was a book called 2010, the book was published. It was called I Am the Word. And they said that, you know, humanity is a time of reckoning, and a reckoning is a facing of oneself and all of one's creations, and everything that's been created in fear needs to be recreated in a higher way. And they say now in the Book of Truth that truth is here as a vibrational field.
Right.
And that it's actually moving everything that is not based in truth. So every system that we have and that we have invested in that's not working or is corrupt or has become invested by fear is having to be remade or reknown or perhaps released so that something else can come into form.
Got it.
I mean, the guides say, you know, you all say you don't want war, but you've been living on a planet that's always had a war, so you expect to see it, so you're always claiming it again. And all that's going to change this is you lifting to a level of consciousness where war is not possible.
Right.
And that's the work of the time. So I think what we're seeing now, according to the guides, is in some ways a leveling of a lot of these structures that we have counted on and perhaps trusted in always to be there. You know, they say it, at its essence, there's nothing wrong with a bank. They say, you know, the first bank was when some hunter said to somebody else, hold my stuff while I go into the woods. And he became the bank. He was holding everybody's stuff.
Right.
And that was it. And they say that the thumbprint of everybody who's ever put their money in a bank is on every bank you ever walk into. It's a collective structure that we have all invested in over thousands and thousands of years, or however long it's been there. I don't know the history of banking. But that what's now informed the bank needs to be transformed. So the idea of the bank itself may be perfectly fine. What the bank has become may not be fine. Mm. And this whole idea of recreation, things being renown in a higher way, is what they're speaking to. And they say it's happening now. It's great change.
Yeah,
they did a lecture, and it's interesting. It's actually up on YouTube, called Great Change, that they delivered 3 days before the last election. Mm-hmm. And it was quite prophetic mm-hmm. in terms of some of what we're looking at. But they say in that lecture, you know, your idea, and I'm going to probably get this wrong, but something like your idea of choice is I'm going to have the milk or the cream in my coffee. And what you're about to be looking at is what happens when the table that was holding the milk and the cream get turned over.
Yeah.
This is a whole other thing. And you need to be prepared for this, but also to be prepared for the great potential for good that lies through this process of transformation. It is a release of the old.
Right.
And they say, you know, you can't claim the new when you're hanging on to the old.
That's right.
Can't happen.
And they also say to find the God in everything and everyone, even the person that cuts you off in traffic or murders a child.
They do.
There's still God in all of us, in everything.
They do say that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they say again and again and again, you cannot be the light and hold another in darkness. You can't do it.
Right.
And as you align to the divine self or the true self, which you can call the God within or the true self as God, mm-hmm. not that you're the only one, you're an aspect of the great whole, as is everybody else, they say God sees God in everything.
Yeah.
The divine witnesses the divine in all it sees.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is, you know. And you really then don't get to decide what is holy. They say everything is holy. All is holy because it is.
Mm-hmm.
Things may be vibrating at different levels.
Right.
But our idea of what's good is basically based on what's preferable and what we like
mm-hmm.
and what we were told to believe in.
Right.
And, you know, they do say all is holy. All is holy. Everything is. You can't exclude anything from it because, you know, they say what you put in darkness, you tie yourself to.
Right.
You bind yourself to.
So a friend called me today and told me that he had gone into a meeting with a boss
uh-huh.
that they were just fighting like oil and water prior. But mm-hmm. he had read the chapter 6 of my new book where I uh-huh. interview you, Paul. And you talked about that and seeing the God in everything. And he thought, oh, my gosh, I have to try to see the God in this person. So he did. And he said some prayers. And he said, I know who I am in truth. I know what I am in truth. I know how I serve in truth. And he mm-hmm. did all this work. But he still had his note cards just in case he had to go have that conversation that was a difficult conversation. But by neutralizing things back to truth and back to seeing the God in this person, he said he walked into the office and there was the person standing there and like, apologizing for the fight that they had just had.
Mm-hmm.
It neutralized the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
And is that because of the vibration of truth came into the space? Truth, love, compassion?
Well, what I actually get is yes. I mean, the claim, I know who I am in truth, I know what I am in truth, I know how I serve in truth, the guides say is something that's said by the true self.
Yeah.
So it's not done at the level of personality, which is I'm the employee, this is the boss, and I screwed up or he screwed up and we're going to, you know, whatever.
Right.
That's the small self stuff. So the aspect that says this knows it's always true. The divine self always knows who it is
mm-hmm.
and what it is, which means in manifestation. And how the divine self serves, or the true self serves, is how it's most fully expressed in all ways.
Right.
In its expression. And in truth means that it's in the vibration or field of truth. And the guides say, in truth, a lie cannot be held.
Right.
And fear is a lie.
And any decision made in fear does not stick.
Well, no, it can stick. A decision made in fear can stick, but it's going to get you more fear.
I see. It just brings on more fear.
Yeah, look at every choice. Look at the last choice you made because you were afraid
mm-hmm.
And see what it got you. And the guides say, you know, there's never been a lie told that hasn't been told in fear.
Mm-hmm.
Every lie we tell is because we're frightened of something.
Right.
But as I said, it always gets us more of the same. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things that they've been very helpful with me about in my life is not choosing in fear.
Right.
Because then I don't have to sort of live with the ramifications. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you look at our world right now and we're being told to fear everybody mm-hmm. and these people are going to get us and you look at the actions we take in fear, mm-hmm. what does that mean? We build a bigger bomb? We build a higher wall? I mean, it's really all about separation.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't work. I mean, it's the antithesis of any true spiritual teaching, as far as I can find.
Right.
You know, either we're all in this together or we're not.
Right.
You know, and the idea that we're not is all about separation, and it's the hypocrisy of most religion, unfortunately, because I think the truth of every religion would tell you this in one way.
And you talk in your books, as the channels come through, with saying the Christ. And, you know, you're raised, it was agnostic.
Agnostic atheist, yeah.
There you go. That's a good combo for you to be saying the Christ.
Yeah, that's what the guides teach. The guides teach the Christ. Mm-hmm. But their definition of the Christ is, as the, like they say, the Christ is the aspect of the Creator that can be realized in material form.
Right.
As who and what you are, and the what's the big one, because that's mm-hmm. what they're starting to teach now, which means in manifestation. The Christ is you in manifestation, not as an idea.
Right.
But in form and feel, the body and the energetic field, your consciousness expressed as you at this level of alignment, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word. So they do use that word, but they unpack it to mean what they say was its intended meaning, mm-hmm. always.
Always. Know. And you talk also, Jeffrey, is it Kripal?
Jeffrey Kripal.
Jeffrey Kripal, he's, you know, he did the intro for Mastery, correct?
He wrote the introduction for the Book of Mastery.
That's right. Yes, wonderful. And he talks about how what you're talking about is this is ancient Christianity, second mm-hmm. century Christianity.
Yeah. Jeff is the, I believe he's still the head of the religious studies department at Rice University, and he's a wonderful scholar, and he's actually written books on world religions.
Right.
And he's an expert on Gnosticism. And we taught together at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur for a month, where he was in dialogue with the guides before a group of students.
Nice.
And asking them questions about their teaching. And he says, yeah, he says this is like second century Christianity before the religion was established around it. And then Victoria Nelson, who's been on the phone during the dictations for most of the books,
sure.
She actually believes it's a hermetic teaching, which goes mm-hmm. back even farther. And because the guides are really talking about the divination of the body.
Right.
Now, that's a big part of their teaching, whereas I don't know that the Gnostics were very fond of the body. They thought mm-hmm. the body was something we were sort of stuck in. Now, I'm not a Gnostic scholar. I read one book on it years ago by Elaine Pagels that was wonderful, mm-hmm. and that was it. That's all
that's
I know.
One. Yeah.
That's it. But that's what I'm being told. It's not a new teaching. It's coming in a way for our time, but it's also coming with evidence. It's coming with vibration. People are reading the books, and the guides say this. The books operate on two levels. There are the words on the page, and there's the energy that informs the words.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are having these energetic shifts or phenomena while they're experiencing the book. So if you go to the reviews on Amazon, you mm-hmm. see I'm reading the book, my body's vibrating. I'm reading the book and I'm seeing auras. And mm-hmm. this kind of thing has been happening since the beginning.
Now, for Nightline to call you the love psychic, I have a problem with this because yeah. it's media, of course, coming uh-huh. up with a hook.
Yep.
And you're not predicting people's future if they're going to buy a house or if they're going to go to Guatemala. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you are encompassing, as you say, you're stepping into somebody who is mm-hmm. living, understanding personality, understanding mm-hmm. a dynamic, maybe why the fears are uh-huh. there. So if somebody were to call you up and want a reading and ask you mm-hmm. to make predictions, that's not something you do, really.
I do it okay. as part of my practice, but it's not my favorite part of the practice.
But the guides will come in or you will get some insights on this?
You know, I'll give you a bad example. I was okay. reading for some woman once, and she's a professional woman, you know, and
yeah.
this is New York, and she showed up, and I think she came in person. I don't think it was done on the phone. It was a person reading. Anyway, and she said, am I ever going to meet somebody? And I think I said to her, yeah, at a potluck. And she rolled her eyes. And I knew this was somebody who would never be caught dead at a potluck in her life.
Right, yeah.
And she wrote me a year later, and she said, listen, I got invited to a potluck, and I only went because of this reading. and I met the man I'm marrying. Do you know what I mean? So it happens with regularity. People want to know.
Sure.
What I can be helpful with, frankly, and I do a fair amount of this, and I don't know why, because I don't own any property, mm-hmm. but I tune into houses that people are thinking about buying, and I'm seeing, you know, the cracks in the cellar and the termites and, you know, and the shingles and the roof is going to go in a year. And you got, so I do some of that stuff, and yeah. I do the predictive work, but I'm not going to tell people what to do. When
right.
people say, should I move to Guatemala or Buenos Aires? It's like, where do you want to be?
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. I can tune into them in both of those choices and feel where they feel the most realized and happy.
Yes.
You know, but it's not about taking away one's free will. It's really, I think, what I'm supportive of people in is moving out some of the blocks that may be stopping them from knowing what they truly need.
Yes. When we met a year ago and I asked you about some career things and I was feeling blocked and uh-huh. you said there's a big yellow tractor right in the middle of the road. And it's like, how do I move this tractor? And you're so frustrated that the tractor is there. And the only way the tractor was going to move by my allowance of it. Thank mm-hmm. you, tractor. You can move now. Mm-hmm. Instead of my trying to push it out of the middle of the road, which I couldn't do in my current form. I can't push a tractor.
Uh-huh.
And so that was very symbolic for me about the allowance of something to mm-hmm. get out of the way for the other to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very helpful for
Good.
Me. And the other thing, too, is when I talked with you about some people in my life, I remember asking you about my mother, and you just became my mother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you turned into her, your voice, your intonation. She does like this kind of up and down thing with her voice, and you just, bam, it was really, really neat to see that because we were doing this via Skype.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you explain how that works? It's from a time-space, mm-hmm. metaphysical way, right? For somebody who would be sitting in the audience and they're a skeptic and their arms are folded and they're going, how the heck does he know what Jen's mom is like? Oh, he must have, you know, looked her up and my mom's not on YouTube. Forget it. What do you think is going on? Explain what you think is happening there.
I think in a way it's a form of psychometry, which is, you know, somebody gives you a watch and they tune into the person's watch and the vibrations in the watch. And
mm-hmm.
I use the name of the person. So if you give me your mother's whole name, first name, maiden name, married name is usually what I would want.
Mm-hmm.
I actually find her, I just use that like as a pin, as a coordinate.
Yeah.
And I go to her.
Yep.
And then I step in. I just become the person. And then I have to interpret. So in a way, I'm reading her energy first, you see.
Sure.
I'm interpreting what it's like. So, and there's a whole series of symbols that come through. So if I tune into, say, your mother,
mm-hmm.
and my arms fold across my chest and I frown, that's somebody who's resolved.
Yep.
So I feel the resolution. Very often I tune into people and the middle finger comes up waving in the air. And that doesn't necessarily mean screw you. It means back off, boundary, I'm in charge.
Got it.
If you come to me for a reading and you say, tell me about this guy that I'm interested in,
yes.
and I step into him and my tongue starts wagging in my mouth, it's lust and there's attraction. If the tongue comes wagging out of my mouth and I'm looking all over the place, he's attracted to everybody.
Yeah.
If he starts looking at you and then he starts to look behind you, I know that there's somebody else coming from behind.
Got it.
And you're not the only one. If they go back and forth between two people. So I'm becoming them and then I'm reading them.
Yes.
But as I step in, I may start to feel pain in the body that they may be holding. And I'm not a medical intuitive, but there are things that I do feel that I'm very accurate about. But I can hear them then at different levels as well. And I often take on their expressions.
Sure.
And I don't know how that happens. I think that it's not a lot. I think that this is sort of the body is kind of I want to say it's a shell,
mm-hmm.
but it can be stepped into, or the energy field is really what I'm stepping into. So I'm literally just becoming the other people. It's like assuming a character.
Right.
But I don't have any of the information about the character when I step in. It's like I step in first to the costume and the attitude of the character, and then I try to understand who I am through that, and then I start to hear and then become them in relationship to the subject primarily.
Okay.
I do a lot of work, for example, with parents for some reason and their kids.
Sure.
You know, I've got an 18-year-old daughter. She's not speaking to me. What's going on? And I can usually help, you know, because I can become the kid and I can find out what happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm not spying, but I'm usually helpful in finding out where nobody's hearing each other.
Right.
You know, and what's really going on. You may tell me at a higher level, a client may say what's really going on in a way that the personality self won't.
And Sammy Hagar very openly credits you for helping to save his marriage when he was in a tumultuous time.
That's why they call me the love psychic.
There you go.
That's ABC interviewed Sammy and his wife.
Yes.
And they focused on the work that I do in relationships with people. But Sammy didn't know who I was from a hole in the wall. He was referred to me by somebody that he knew who I'd been working with. And I didn't know who Sammy was because I really didn't. I didn't know his name. I heard there's a big guy coming. He's a big name. He's going to show up. I didn't know who he was. And this guy showed up and says, I'm Sammy in my apartment. And I didn't know.
Right.
I knew he was in rock and roll and that was it. But I didn't know anything. And then, you know, he was very open and it helps to be open. But I stepped into his wife. And that's what I think happened for Sammy was I became his wife. And I'm, you know, a heavy set guy in his mid-50s and she's this beautiful
Gorgeous blonde,
you know. But I became her, and suddenly, I guess, I was saying to him and wagging my finger at him in the way that she had been doing. But he was able to hear what she was saying.
Through you.
Through me.
Got it.
You see? And that was the revelation.
Yes.
You know? And then I've read for them both, and they're lovely, lovely people. You know? Everybody's, you know, when you get to everybody at a certain level, there's tremendous goodness, and you really have to just move beyond everybody's ideas of who they think they're supposed to be or who we think they are to the truth of who someone is. I mean, that's the only way to be effective in this work.
You say that everything that's in our life is something that we've somehow agreed to internally.
Yeah.
So for somebody who's listening to this, if they have, you know, someone in their life that's just a challenge, right?
Yeah.
Or very toxic or verbally abusive. I mean, how is it that they've agreed to that somehow? Is there a wound inside? I mean, how do the guides explain that?
Well, I suppose it would vary from person to person, and I wouldn't want to do a one-size-fits-all.
Right.
But what the guides say is we're agreeing to everything. That doesn't necessarily mean we made it so, but it means that we're in energetic accord to it. And I would say this is true both individually and collectively.
Right.
So there's individual accord, which is why I married my partner, for example, you know, and who we are to one another. But then there's collective accord, which means the collective things that we all agree to that we're always perpetuating. And this can be cultural agreements about what it means to be successful. And, you know, everybody that comes to me for a reading now wants to know about their career, my career. I don't think 30 years ago everybody had a career.
Right.
I think they had work. They had things they cared about. But this collective agreement that we're supposed to be realized in certain ways is informing how everybody's choosing their life. And it's probably a load of crap if you think about it.
Truly.
Really.
Yeah.
How do you want to spend your time? What do you give to the world? You know, how do you, what can you offer? So what was your question again? I'm sorry, I went off.
No, if somebody has somebody in their life who's a toxic reminder.
Oh, I've had plenty of them.
Yeah.
You know, I've had plenty of them.
Is that something they somehow agreed to? But you said you don't want to do a generality.
Well,
but,
you know, I can speak in my own way, I suppose. I mean, I think sometimes there are karmic relationships and there are things, people that we call that we have stuff to work out with.
A coworker that's really annoying, an iron in our, a thorn in our side, I would say, is somebody we might have had a past life with.
That's possible. But, you know, I think that we also have to understand that everybody, every situation is an opportunity to learn.
Right.
And it may be that we have choice and we can leave the situation, you know, and that we're not a victim.
Right.
I mean, there's all kinds of ways to look at these things. So why one person attracts a bad relationship, you know, it can be for any number of reasons. It can be low self-esteem. It can be any of these things, or they don't deserve that they believe a good one. What the guides often say is we're always getting what we expect at a certain level, that we're really complicit in everything. And the example they use is, you know, the person that says they're always dating jerks, every time they date another jerk, they get to be right.
Right.
You know, I used to say I attracted a certain kind of crazy person in my life. And I did for years. And I haven't for years now. And I'm so happy that doesn't seem to be that part of my life. And by crazy, I just mean a certain kind of intensity.
Yes.
And
yes.
Need.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, I don't. And I look at the people in my life now And for the most part, I'm extremely fortunate. And I'm very wonderful people,
right,
you know, around me now that have shown up. And a lot of the other people have fallen away for whatever reasons. And I think some of that has to do with this idea of energetic accord.
Right.
It's not that everything is great and I don't have problems, and I do, and there's plenty of areas that I have work to do and some areas of my life, and I can say, well, why am I still attracting this thing that I say that I don't want?
Like, yeah.
But I have to do the work there. So, I mean, the guides will tell me if I ask, or they'll tell me through another medium, because I get readings from people that I respect as well. So why do we do this? I'm going to ask them because you're choosing to learn through them. I hear because you're choosing to learn through them. And when you don't need the lesson anymore, you will stop claiming it.
Got it.
That's it.
So it's all about learning and evolving. And if we haven't quite learned that lesson, another person will come in a different costume,
yeah,
and bring it up for us to learn again.
Exactly right.
Okay. Yay. Well, that's good to know. So for anyone out there who's listening and you seem to have this perpetual challenge with a coworker or a parent or a sibling, there's something that you are still needing to learn from it. And so instead of hitting the tennis ball back over the net and trying to spike it with a vengeance, ask what is it that you could learn from this so that you can get past it and not have to repeat it, right?
Yes, I could, yes.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you or the guides would like to leave with our listeners before we wrap this up? Because like you say, it's a very general, a very questing audience, but any guidance that you would like to leave us with would be welcomed.
I'll go to the guides if you want.
Sure.
For the guides,
sure,
because
sure.
You know, I had some sugar before this interview, and I can't drink sugar. I mean, it was in my tea, and I'm like doing my best not to sort of float away on a sugar high. So I'm going to let the guides, who, you know, I don't think they're that affected by this. But I should say that when I channel, I whisper the words and I repeat them. People hear things twice. It's
sure.
A little weird to listen to, but it's just how it comes through. But I'm going to say we would like to say a few things. They're saying we would like to say a few things about who everybody is, about who everybody is beyond what they have claimed and agreed to be, and agreed to be the true self as you. The true self as you, which is our teaching, is available as you allow it, as you agree it can be so. And if you wish to do this, you may say these words. I know I'm in truth. I know who I am in truth.
I know who I am in truth.
I know what I am in truth.
I know what I am in truth.
I know how I serve in truth.
I know how I serve in truth.
I am free, I am free, I am free.
I am free, I am free, I am free.
The claim of the true self, I am free, is always so, is always so. The divine as you is free, the divine as you is free. And as she claims these words, she realizes herself. She realizes herself outside of the known, what she agreed to, out of fear, or out of obligation, as each of you evolve in your lives, you realize yourselves through your choices. If you choose in fear, you will learn your lessons that way, but there is no need. We say thank you now for the opportunity to teach. Period. Yeah.
Paul Selig, it's always a pleasure to be around you, to hear what you have to say, what they have to say. We will continue to watch with bated breath for the next book. And please, always, when you're in Chicago, I hope you can stop by the studio for more encounters. PaulSelig.com, SELIG.com is how you spell the last name, by the way. PaulSelig.com for information, for books, for the Love Psychic clip, for all your workshops and events coming up as you're traveling all around. You're in Chicago this weekend. We're very blessed to have you up at the DoubleTree in Skokie. And some slots are still available if you are tuning in and want to go meet Paul in person. Thank you, Paul, for all you do.
Thanks for having me.